Hi, my name is Tracy Schultz. I am the engineer of RAG Radio. For this week's episode of RAG Radio, we are rebroadcasting the audio of an event that was held at Book People here in Austin, Texas. On January 5th, 2017, your RAG Radio host, Thorne Dreyer, along with Alice Embry and Richard Croxdale, were celebrating the launch of their book, Celebrating the RAG, Austin's Iconic Underground Newspaper, with a discussion and Q&A. We also get the chance to hear from contributors Alan Pogue and Carry On. Here is the audio of that event. Enjoy.
So, without further ado, tonight we are here with the editors of the renowned underground newspaper, The Rag, Thorne Dreyer, Alice Embry, and Richard Croxdale. The Rag brought radical thought, action, art, belief, and protest to the Austin public in the 60s and 70s, and they have put together a collection of the Rag's greatest hits alongside reflections and recollections from the present day. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to them. Let's give them a round of applause.
Okay. How's that? Look, Alice, it's the RAG staff. I'm the opening act. I wanted to say that we actually weren't editors of the RAG.
The RAG had no editors.
I kind of was, because I was the original, along with Carol Neiman, I was the original funnel. And that was an interesting concept that we came up with, because it's the idea you pour something in and then hopefully something coherent comes out. But most of the time, the RAG either was run by a collective or just not run by anybody, run by everybody. And so it was a very democratic process. It was actually democratic all the way through, and it was always run by the staff. As many of you know, the RAG first came out in October 1966, and this past October, which was 2016, wasn't it? We celebrated in a pretty massive event the 50th anniversary of the RAG, and since the RAG still exists in the RAG blog and RAG radio, our slogan was 50 years and still raising hell. So and we are. Out of the reunion, we had the reunions in multiple venues, and we had a lot of fun. There was a big concert at Threadgill's. We had a bunch of stuff, a bunch of great stuff that went on at Austin Community College. And one of the things that was premiered there was a film about the RAG, which Richard Croxdale and Glenn Scott, who's Glenn here? produced, or
she's
involved in producing. And it was... And Richard's going to talk about that in a second, I think, as a way to kick off understanding of how you learn about the RAG over time. But we're going to first talk about the kind of three eras of the RAG. We're first going to talk about how the RAG was put together. That's right. We turned it around. How we put the book together.
The book.
And then we're going to go through kind of the three eras, the RAG, how it came about, what the genesis of it was. So, Richard, I guess? Oh, let me say one thing. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and I was the original funnel of the RAG, and I edit the RAG blog and host RAG Radio and have done a number of things in the middle. Alice was one of the founders of the RAG, was involved with the RAG off and on through its whole existence, and is a longtime Austin activist and was a veteran of the women's movement. Richard Croxdale teaches economics at Austin Community College. And he worked with the RAG in its later days and is also involved with people's history in Texas and with making a film about the RAG. Richard.
Yes, I'm Richard Croxdale, and I was at the end of the RAG and was one of the ones who carried it off to the dump. So I have fond memories of it. But after that, I started working with People's History in Texas, and we started doing video documentaries. And I'm not sure what year it was, but on the 39th anniversary of the founding of the RAG, there was another reunion, and we were invited to interview people, and we interviewed somewhere between 30 and 40 people, and we're still sort of in the process of finalizing the documentary, but it is somewhat completed, and you can find it on YouTube. It's in three parts. Part one, which is, talks about the early years of sort of dealing with the anti-war. Part two, which mostly deals with the women's movement. And part three, which is when the RAG sort of began to move to community sorts of activities. When you make a documentary, the biggest problem is not the interviews. I mean, there is a problem in trying to get the people to actually say what it is you want them to say. Thorne and Dreyer had no problem with that. But the biggest problem is finding graphics to cover up the uhs and the burps and the sort of, you know, rolling of the eyes sort of thing. And we decided, my colleague and I, we decided we were just going to use the RAG itself as our graphics. And so by this time, most of it had become digitized. And so we were scrolling through, you know, those 11 years of those beautiful RAGs, and we were looking at it on a computer, and so we would blow it up to be able to see the graphics. And after a while, I began to actually read the words that were going along with it and began to say, wow, this is some really good stuff, you know. And as I began to read more of it, you know, I says, wow, this is truly amazing. And I went to Alice and started telling her about it and said, Alice, we need to do something about that. And then Alice says, well, let's do a book. And so that's the genesis of the book.
And I didn't even know that.
So about, took us 9 months, normal gestation period. We began, and it took a village. We began by getting a lot of people involved who looked at the images from the RAG and chose best of. They, you know, you got a year, and you had to go through the year, and you had to look for the best articles in the year. And then we had to cull down from that. And I just want to mention, because Roger is here, Phil Prim is not here, but one of the things that happened is that Phil Prim, who was with the paper forever, had the entire collection. And Roger and Phil took photographs, literally, of every page. That's 6,000 photographs, JPEGs. And that was part of our resource, because we could go there and look at that. And so we had a lot of people working on making choices, Hunter, Phil, Glenn, us, Bridget Tobin, I don't know if she's here, Carol Neiman. And then we had all of us trying to assemble the story of the RAG. And the RAG started small. This is it, and it fed off a sheet-fed 1250, which is a very hard way to print. I'm a printer, so I know, or I was a printer. And it lasted 11 years, and that's part of the real story of the RAG, because many newspapers that began at the same time sputtered out or met the women's movement and did not move on. And one of the things that I believe is really important is that the RAG embraced the women's movement. It got new content in, and that, you know, I think that that had a lot to do with the fact that it lasted 11 years, and that in that period of time, it really tells a story about Austin. It's a small Austin, 200,000 people then, half the enrollment at UT then, cheap Austin to live in then. This was all a volunteer effort, and some of the people who worked on it through all those periods, I mean, they're all here, and I hope we can call out some of those names and that we can have some interaction. So I think it's really a window. The book is a window to the countercultural and political upheaval, and it's a window toward building a community of resistance. And if we don't need that now, I don't know what we need, okay? So it has lessons in it, and it has very early ideas that Richard will make note of on the third section. And it has really early thought on the women's movement. And there are some people here who can tell even more of that story about the RAG's connection with Roe v. Wade in 1973. And so We cull through, shows 100 articles, and then I want to call out, my husband did not work on the Rag, but he's in the Rag family by marriage, and which he may regret. But he spent a long time, he's an artist, and he reminded me frequently that the reason he read the Rag was not the words in the Rag, but the artwork and the ads in the Rag. And so Carry On is here, one of the major artists, Alan Pug, who did so many photographs that make this paper amazing. And so because of the work that we had, the digital work, it was possible to go through and get that artwork and make it live again. High contrast, you know, off the kind of raggedy pages. And that's what makes this book beautiful and unique, among other things. The 100 articles, the artwork, the photographs, and the story of Austin that it tells.
And there's a lot of new material, too, that was written to kind of give context to it. One thing, by the way, I want to point out is that it was not this size the whole 11 years.
No, it started small.
It started just the first few issues, and then it just grew, and so it wouldn't fit in there. I just want to make another comment about the process, the actual physical process of putting the book together. It was a mother to edit to do everything, because everybody had the original Rag. There were typos. There were inconsistencies. You'd find a line left out. Mm-hmm. You'd have scans that you could hardly read, and so we had to take all of that stuff. And we made a decision that we weren't going to change the essence. We weren't going to really change any articles. We would correct spelling. You know, we would correct typos. We would try to have some stylistic consistency. But we wanted to retain the original articles. I wrote new headlines for them, but they were still the original. They were the articles. But then they had to come in. Somebody had to type them off of the scans of the Rag.
And then we paid the typist.
And we even paid the typist. It was one of the few. It was the only. No.
It's the first time in history.
And the transcribers is really what they call them. And so then we had to go through the editing process to sort of do all of this, getting a little bit of stylistic consistency, all these kind of things. And it was hard. It was a very difficult editorial process. And we farmed stuff out, and then it came back, and I kind of ended up kind of doing final edits on everything. But all of us were involved in the process. All of us were involved in the layout process, and it was really a collective effort. You know, Carlos is a hero for the way he went through everything and found all of this incredibly precious art. And then we had to figure out how to use it and how to make it. You know, we didn't want to make an underground newspaper, but we wanted it to be contemporary in some ways in style, but we wanted to also, with that art, it's got the underground look. It's got the look of the era. So, anyway, it was a really hard process, but it was a labor of love. Actually, a hard labor of love. It was hard labor. No, but anyway, it was really very rewarding.
So, and we knew we had to get it done by the Rag reunion. That was our hard deadline, because we had to have the copies there so that the people that came to the Rag reunion could take them with them.
Or it would still be in the works.
Yeah, it's available here. It's available also at Book Woman, at Willie's, at Planet K, and directly through Lulu. So, and let me just say, we chose several new pieces. That one was some of the untold stories. Vietnam veterans against the war. We asked Terry DeBose to write something about that, and he did. And so we have a whole section on that. We have a section by Sharon Shelton Colangelo, and I don't see her here, but on the women's movement and the Rag. And we kind of pay homage to Judy Smith, who was so critically important on Roe v. Wade, as was Barbara here. And then Glenn Scott, who was working on the film, did a piece on the RAG's coverage of labor movements and the really critical work with Chicano, mostly Chicano labor strikes that were going on that kind of laid a basis in 1972 when they moved the voting age downward and students who had been activated became involved in alliances with Chicanos and blacks in this city and helped kind of reshape a lot of the local politics.
One thing is that when we went through the articles to the each year to pick out the articles we wanted to run, we didn't just look for the best articles, and there were probably some very, very good articles that we didn't, but we looked for articles that were somehow representative. We looked for articles that fit certain we wanted to make sure we had labor articles. We wanted to make sure we had certain kinds of music, certain kind of things. So it was a selective choosing, but obviously, how many articles would you say were in the 380 issues in the RAG? You couldn't do it all. So. Okay.
Break it down by section.
Where are we now?
Hmm? Break it down by section.
Okay.
Okay. All right, we're going to talk a little bit about, vaguely by eras, because we sort of, we represent different eras of the RAG, and the RAG, we had to arbitrarily kind of divide into three periods. And I'm going to talk about the beginning, not just the RAG, but also the context, the national context that it came in. It was 1966 was a remarkable time. It was at the heart of when the New Left, the sort of underground counterculture, the Vietnam War was escalating. There was this incredible sense, this palpable sense of something happening and of a need to be committed. I mean, it was a remarkable time, and other underground papers had started in other places, a few of them. For instance, an Esquire reporter visited the Los Angeles Free Press office in 1970, observed, "Kids, dogs, cats, barefoot waifs, teeny boppers in see-through blouses, assorted losers, strangers, Indian chiefs wander in and out, while somewhere a radio plays endless rock music and people are loudly paged over an intercom system. It's all very friendly and rather charming and ferociously informal." Well, that's not like what the RAG was. That's L.A. That's an L.A. version. So there were lots of different kinds of papers all over the country. The RAG was incredibly important. It was the first paper in the South. It was the sixth member of the Underground Press Syndicate. It was the first paper to combine a sort of New Left and hippie counterculture, to combine those cultures, those movements, into what became a really potent political force. The RAG was always an involved kind of journalism, and everybody, people who we'd cover, as Harvey Stone said, we'd call for a demonstration, we'd go out and cover the demonstration. We'd go out, we'd participate in the demonstration, and then we would come back and write about it. So it was, we made it happen. And that was consistent.
In part because there was no coverage in what we call the straight press. So.
So I want to tell you how I started out. I wrote an article called Rag Mama Rag, and it's sort of period into the kind of to how it got flowing. And it said, starting with a handful of raggedy upstart newspapers, mostly on the East and West Coast, the underground press of the 1960s and 70s quickly spread throughout the country, with papers popping up like magic mushrooms in cities big and small, on college and high school campuses, on military bases, in gay communities, and counterculture enclaves. They were everywhere. And this is very important. According to John Gordon Burke, writing in his 1972 book Essays on Media, quote, "The most spectacular occurrence in recent journalism was the overnight emergence of the underground press." And the New Yorker's Louise Menand later called the underground press movement one of the most spontaneous and aggressive growths in publishing history. We were the sixth. There were ultimately probably 500 with a circulation that went into the tens of millions, especially with repeat, the pass on. There was incredible pass on of the underground papers. So Austin was a point of origin for much of what happened in the 60s. Much of the what became identified with San Francisco, much of the music culture, a lot of it actually started in Austin. And Austin's New Left and SDS were very unique. They were different from other parts of the country. It was all very – and all the politicos were a little bit hip, and the hippies were a little bit politically committed. And so the paper did a whole lot to actually transform the university. It became very active. We created all kinds of events, and there was a cascading series of events that ended up with thousands of people on the main mall. It was the University Freedom Movement. And that followed General Thursday, which was a remarkable thing that the RAG mostly organized, and that the university eventually banned. It was just show up, bring all your cool stuff, you know, bring your kids and everything. And when the university banned it, it became a political movement. Anyway, it was a very important. It was also the first underground newspaper to really grow directly out of an activist community. I mean, the SDS, you know, the people who started the RAG and who ran the RAG were also in SDS and were also part of that whole movement. So, I could go on, but they won't let me. we forgot to bring a hook. So,
well, I'll say something that's in the movie, that when six of us got put on disciplinary probation for giving a speech on the UT campus against the war, and we had a great constitutional lawyer, professor, Fred Cohen.
Oh.
I know Dave Richards is here, but he's another one, but who defended us. And five of the six were members of the RAG staff. So they have a tremendous overlay there in terms of people who were working on the RAG, writing on the RAG, and active in anti-war activity. And, you know, one of the things we tried to do was describe that University Freedom Movement, and then we also did a lot on the Kent State, you know, because in 65 you had 15 people out here against the capital, against the war in Vietnam, and in 1970, you had 25,000. And it's that arc of radical activity that happened, and there are some wonderful pictures and articles about the Kent State demonstrations. And we haven't really talked about artists yet.
No, the RAG was, did you want to do that, or? The RAG was a starting point for a lot of artists. It offered a canvas to a lot of – there was an amazing art scene, underground art scene, cartoonists. It is arguably the first underground comic book started in Austin. And there were people like Jim Franklin, Gilbert Shelton, the fabulous Furry Freak Brothers started in the RAG and then became an international phenomenon, and his collected works are still in print in 11 languages, I think, or something like that. So it was a grun, you know. Trudy Minkoff, people would come and sit at the layout sessions, which were crazy, crazy scenes. Nobody knew what they were doing. Everybody would take a page. Things weren't consistent. It just had to grow, and we had to learn. But people would sit down and do little drawings and to fit in with the art. Plus, we would have the major works, you know, the cover works that people like Carrie and others would bring in. So it was a remarkable, and it was a place where the ads, early ads, I mean, it never had a lot of ads. You've got to understand, the RAG was never about money. The underground papers in general were never about money, or some of them maybe were, but, and we never made any money. And there was a period of time where it was really, the RAG would be hanging by a thread. You know, there was.
I'll say, Hunter Ellinger's here, and he worked on this book project. He also read an article in here on the finances of the RAG, and it's there that you can see that we had no business plan. We had a lot of people who were willing to donate their labor, and we sold a few copies, and we sold a few ads, and the rents were low, and living expenses were low, and this maintained itself for 11 years as a labor of love. I'll say just a bit about my own experience with the RAG I did not write an article until a year after the RAG had started. I typed, and then we typed. I won't go into it. We typed everything twice so that we could justify it. It's a long story, but
one of the stupidest decisions in history.
And then I came back to Austin in 70, And the women's movement was blossoming. And that is a period of time when some very significant women had a very significant role at the RAG, Judy Smith, Linda Smith, and Barbara Hines. And so during that period, the content changed, the women's leadership changed, women's participation changed, women wrote more articles. And because I lived in Austin and was around during the whole 11 years, it was a part of the time that I really felt very close to the paper, even though I wasn't down there doing layout. It was always the place where you could go when you had a chili. The Austin Committee for Human Rights in Chile had a demonstration, and you had to get something in. And there's a wonderful, it was 1975, a wonderful series of articles in here about alternative institutions, the Women's Health Organization, which Alice Gwynne was in, the Women's Bookstore, which Bookwoman kind of is the survivor of, two calendars, one on women in labor, not just labor history, but one Glenn worked on and another one. And I'm leaving a few things out, but there was also a peer counseling project. And this was a period when women's activity began to shape things like that were unheard of, like rape counseling centers or domestic violence support networks. And you also had, from the very beginning all the way to the very end, you had this whole strand of gay liberation that was running through. So the last article we have in here is actually about the fight at A&M over a gay organization on campus. And we had an attorney in Austin helping the students at A&M get recognized on campus. So this was a whole very important and exciting period, particularly for a lot of women. It was a time when the RAG really ran some of the first thought on women's liberation. And it, so I feel, even though I wasn't like down there laying the paper out, I felt very close to that period of time. And I'm going to turn it to you, Richard, on the some of the community aspects and labor coverage.
We broke the RAG down into three sections. The first one was anti-war. The second was the women's movement. And by the time that I got there, the focus had changed. And certainly the anti-war was included, and certainly the women's feminist issues. But this is 1972. Nixon has won his second election. You know, it's like the world's going to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, the SDS is pretty much gone by then. Weather Underground is a joke. The Black Panther Party has been destroyed. They're dismantling the war on poverty. And a lot of people sort of said, we can't change America. You know, we need to create a bubble for ourselves. We need to create a community of our own. And so the RAG, as well as the movement, became much more focused on our community. And they started looking at things that were there, sort of like, what does this county commissioners actually do? You know, what are they talking about in the city council? You know, sort of like, I'm kind of worried about the environment. What do I do with all this stuff I'm throwing away? You know, and so this thing begins to fill with recycling, with how to eat properly. And also getting involved in local struggles, and sort of the labor struggles and the gay struggles. And how come there are no sidewalks in East Austin? You know, and sort of they're building apartments above Barton Springs. They're ruining it. Mm-hmm. We've got to stop it. And so it was this movement towards sort of just creating your own community. And probably one of the more, when you read it, we've only got one or two articles, but there was a series of articles about the city council by Bill Meacham and Peter Davis and Jim Locke that are just truly genius. And I say this as an academic looking backward, and it's sort of that they started going to city council, and they actually started reporting on what these people were saying. And Nobody else was doing this. And the Rag started that whole tradition of actually listening to what they say. And I know in the movie, you know, Bill Meacham sort of, we may not have actually included this, but he tells this story that after about a couple of years of doing this, Roy Butler calls him into his office and says, "Aren't you being kind of mean to me?" You know, and they began to realize that the Rag actually was talking to a lot of people, and they were listening to what they were saying, and they couldn't be talking nasty about citizens because they were gonna publish it, and so that was sort of the move when I was there, sort of creating this bubble of a community that people could feel safe. You know, it's okay, this is my community and this is the way that I want to live, and it was very deliberately done. And there's actually a quote by Judy Smith in the documentary where she says this, that we just sort of, you know, we just got to go out there and just sort of, where we can, do what we can. So that's the period that I worked in, third one.
Kind of the drill down period. Like the period of co-ops, the origin of Wheatsville housing co-ops. You know, a lot of alternative, Greenbrier, a lot of alternative institutions begin to spring up and flourish and get reported on in the Rag.
And are we going to be ready to go to questions? Do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think we should get y'all to talk.
Yeah, I want to read one thing first so that you know the impact we had. This is from Joe Poole, the late Texas congressman and acting chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said, and I quote, "These smut sheets are today's Molotov cocktails thrown at respectability and decency in our nation.
There you go. Yay!
They encourage depravity and irresponsibility, and they nurture a breakdown in the continued capacity of the government to conduct an orderly and constitutional society. Woo! The plan of this underground press syndicate is to take advantage of that part of the First Amendment which protects newspapers and gives them freedom of the press."
Damn.
But putting it right out there. They know that the more obscene and dirty their newspapers are, the more they will attract the irresponsible readers whom they want to enlist in their crusade to destroy this country.
Oh, that's the question.
I think they gave us an awful lot of credit there. So, do we want to ask Carrie and Alan to say just a couple words or not?
Yeah, we should.
We want to get to questions, but Carrie On is here, and I think Carrie might. Would you like to say just a couple of things, and maybe Alan Pogue, about the experience? Carrie On did some of the most wonderful art.
I see. I'll do show and tell.
This was before he was a stand-up comic.
And before he was a musician. Wait, here we go.
Don't get up.
Okay.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Page
my bad.
279.
To do it.
I will get up. You can sit.
Don't get up. Oh, you meant it.
The only reason I'm really here is because my brother was Thorne's friend in high school, and they started a Three Penny Press. Is that right? The Three Penny Press. Were you with that? In Bel Air High School in Houston, they were already doing the underground newspapers in high school, and that's when I met Thorne.
That was really.
So anyway, okay, you weren't involved. You learned from my brother, in other words. Maybe he started everything. Anyway, in 1966, I drew the cover for the Rag, and that's not in the book, but I was 16 and I was in high school, and I drew the cover, and I was very thrilled. It's like my first job ever to actually do art, kind of, that was published. Yes, $20. No, wait a minute. Y'all didn't pay me. Somebody bought the original for $20. Some art patron came up with $20 and sent me $20 in Houston in high school. And I knew, okay, I'm on my way. That was all it took. And that's the truth. That was the first deal. And you know, 79 years later, whatever it was, here we are now. Still, I know Thorne.
This is the kind of stuff you get.
And Alice, and I'm Richard, I know who you are, but I don't really know you. When I just want to tell you, those SDS meetings were terrible, and they went on for hours and hours. So, I said, look, I'll draw all the stuff, but don't make me go to those meetings. Don't, I'll draw it, call me or whatever, don't. No, there were no phones in those days, of course. There were courier pigeons.
And radios were a new thing.
Right. Anyway, after all those years, it all came down to what we have now, which is Trump America.
And it's
our fault. So it really worked out well.
Alan Pogue is now a renowned documentary photographer, and he started out his renowned
career
his renowned apprenticeship as staff photographer for the RAG.
Here, I'll do show and tell.
And we've got Veterans Against the War, so. Or Vietnam. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's the main thing was, you know, I unfortunately did go to Vietnam, and I was a combat medic, and my mother gave me this little plastic camera, and I started taking pictures, and I thought, well, you know, taking pictures, I really enjoy this stuff, and so I went to Japan and got a good camera. But the main thing was I realized that what I saw was, you know, of course, not what we were told. We were told nothing but lies, and we still are being told nothing but lies with the, you know, mainstream press. And so when I got here to Austin and, you know, signed up to take philosophy at UT, I noticed the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and immediately joined them. And I got a room in the University Y. And the University Y was an incubator for just about everything. And I can't say enough good about it. And particularly, gosh, I'm terrible, Chris Cunningham, who was the director. You know, who allowed me to turn the janitor's closet into my darkroom.
And live in it.
And live in it for God knows. Yeah, my mother said, you know, my son, he lives in a closet and sleeps on a shelf. Well, the deal is if you live in a closet and sleep on a shelf, you don't have any overhead. And so you can do what needs to be done and not have to worry about the fact that no one's going to pay you to do it. So that was great. And on top of that, you know, after having experienced, you know, the insanity of Vietnam and the war, the main thing was having community. And there was a complicated, overlapping community in Austin. I mean, and, you know, you could go to the Armadillo World headquarters and the hardcore Marxists and the biggest dope heads would all be there. And that was very important. And so it's sad to see all of those institutions gone these days, and recreating that sense of community is what we really need most, I think, right now. However, you know, that can be done. But the other thing was, because I was taking pictures, that meant that I was involved in every single sort of thing that was going on. It didn't matter. You know, it didn't matter if it was the Brown Berets or, you know, Community United Front, or the or women and women's issues, going to the Valley. Heck, I went all the way to Oakland. I'm one of the few white guys to say I could. You know, I spent the night in the Oakland Black Panther headquarters because I was taking pictures for Community United Front. And so everybody wanted a picture. They wanted a good picture. So that was an entree into absolutely everything. And it was the best days of my life. Hard none ever. It's great.
I have to tell you that this is such an important event that I actually tucked in a shirt, and it's the first time I don't remember how long that I tucked in a shirt, and I discovered that something had happened since the last time I tucked in a shirt. Anyway, I think we want to open it up for some discussion.
What is to be done?
Does anybody have anything to ask or say? Yeah.
Well, speaking
of... So you guys know everything?
No. There you go. A new journalistic concept that's kind of emerged in the last, very recently. And fake news. How do you think the RAG has been treated after this concept were alive and well in 1967?
Well, of course, there was Paul Krasner, but but that was what we called satire, well, and it's what it's okay, else.
Gulf of Tonkin? I mean, we had fake news, okay?
We had fake news from the what is the mainstream media. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go on.
Oh.
I didn't know if we were done. Well, I just was wondering if you could say more about your relationship to UT, which I know was fraught at times, but it also sounds like you were pretty closely connected.
Should I mention the economy, the Daily Texan?
Well, we should probably, while Dave Richards is here, mention that he took our case to the Supreme Court. Are you here?
He left.
Oh, he couldn't find a place to sit down.
Okay.
They wouldn't let us sell on campus, and he took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
So we filed a suit because we could not sell on campus. Yeah.
And the other thing, by the way, in addition, Dave Richards, you didn't mention the Roe v. Wade.
Well, I did.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
I tried. All right.
I didn't enough. I mean, we have some people here who worked hard on that.
Okay, then I'm crazy.
Okay.
But we know that. I will mention that one of the things that inspired the RAG to start when it did, we had already been talking about doing the paper, but this guy named John Economity was elected editor of the Daily Texan. And Economity was a far right winger, pro-war, pro-administration, and he ran, among other things, on no more women editors. And he won, I think, in there were two runoffs or something, but he won. And Kay Northcott, who had been the editor before, who later was editor of the Texas Observer with Molly Ivins, Kay Northcott wrote our lead story in the very first issue of The Rag talking about him.
And John Economy. Yeah.
And he became the Daily Texan became a PR organ for the University of Texas. That's not really what you're asking, I don't guess. But
it also shared their he shared film. With people who were spying on.
He was a spy. He was a spy for the University Police.
That's an interesting connection. But there was a much more fluid. Campus and more non-students were on campus. There wasn't. I mean, I look at UT now; it's twice as big. It's more of a commuter campus. You can't park near it. There was a much more fluid people who were going to school, who had been to school, who were, and we definitely were part of that university community. But not everybody was a student.
Ken.
You told us how it started and a lot about what the RAG did, but why did it die? I didn't get here until 78. And you died the year before, if I get my math right.
Did. Died in 77. And it's unclear why it folded.
A lot of it,
you know, lately I've been thinking about it, sort of in this context, and it's a lot of work. I mean, you put a weekly newspaper, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of time. And at that time, we probably, because we weren't using, there weren't that many university students who were involved anymore, I think we needed to make a transition to money. We need to actually pay people. And nobody wanted to do that. Nobody wanted to sell those ads. We would have had to do what the Austin Chronicle ultimately did, you know, was to sell those personals, and it's like we just didn't want to do it. And so we just, made a collect. We had the money, we could have continued to produce it, but it was just like, no volunteers are coming out. So we folded it up. But what was happening was that the energy that would have gone into the RAG were going into very specific movements. And so, you know, there was different newsletters for different groups. And I personally went on to work with the anti-nuclear power group. And we put out the Hot Times for 3 or 4 years. And I was doing some tenants work and put out the Texas Tenants newsletter, you know. And so people just moved on to do different things, you know.
And the Austin Sun was there for, 3.5 years there, kind of an overlap a little bit with the tail end of the RAG. And then the Chronicle really had a business plan. Yeah. I mean, honest to God, we didn't. We were a labor of love, and I think people got older. I mean, I remember a very clear decision I made to go to work at the University of Texas because I had insurance. And it was 1979, and I needed some income. And I think a lot of people, as they kind of aged out of full-time activism into maybe raising kids and things like that, I mean, that became an important thing. And we couldn't sustain. I don't think it could have sustained off volunteer labor.
Not off volunteer labor.
Yeah,
and we had a business plan, but nobody wanted to actually go out and do it.
That was
the problem. No, toward the end, there was a group of us, and we were talking and realizing what we needed to actually do, and it was like, God, this is not the way I want to spend my life, going out and selling ads. And so, you know, that was...
What was remarkable was not why it died, but how long it lived, because it outlived almost all of the other underground. It actually outlived all of them, I think, except some that kind of went through some transition. Mm-hmm. And the underground press, and the RAG included, spun off all kinds of activities, spun off other newspapers. Space City, the paper I worked with in Houston later, had started two or helped people with two high school underground papers, started a crisis hotline, started food co-ops, and, you know, even the RAG, that... The RAG spun off both, sort of, I mean, we'd say in a sense, Space City in Houston and RAT in New York, which were two of the most important of that next generation of underground papers. So we all lived on.
So, Alan.
Well, the war in Vietnam was over, and the draft that was gone. And so people's lives were not on the line. And I thought that towards the end, people were thinking, are we going to go monthly or are we going to quit? You know, it's also a lack of readership.
Who else? Yolanda.
I came a little late. I don't know if you've covered this, but you had a wonderful anniversary recently. Would you like to share some of the highlights for those who didn't attend your anniversary celebration?
We had a keynote event, which was RAG Radio broadcast live remote. From Austin Community College, and with Doug Rossenow, who's a pretty well-known historian who wrote a book called The Politics of Authenticity that used the Austin movement as a sort of starting off point for his story, or as a central point. And we also had a young lady named Julia Mickenberg,
American Studies
professor at UT with us. And so that was one cool thing we did.
And then we had Alan Pogue and Terry DeBose, Vietnam Vets Against the War, did a wonderful panel maybe y'all want to say a word.
We had some Iraq vets who were trying to...
We did.
What's the same and what's different?
Right. And what's different in terms of the draft and not the draft. And then we also had the filmmaker of Sir, No Sir, who showed a little bit of the film footage, which if you haven't seen that movie... Look for it.
David Zeiger.
It's on the Olio Strut up in Killeen.
Oh, sir.
And we showed that's what it is.
Oh, and there was I hear there was a great movie there.
Oh, there was
too.
A really
and we showed this
great
incredible
movie.
Documentary.
Yeah, it was a full house.
Well, too. It was probably the largest house of anything.
And we had a women's discussion, a kind of reenactment of Women's Liberation Front. where we all sat in a circle and
we did a sort of reunion of General Thursday at the Vortex Theater outside in the back, which was wonderful.
It was a seven-ring circus.
Dave Mahler, who really helped organize it, was the MC for this. We tried to create as much continuity as we could.
And then Carrie emceed a great event at Threadgill's, and we had music.
Produced it and emceed it.
Produced it and performed in it and emceed it and did the poster for it.
What else? Yeah.
Do you see in the Occupy Austin movement anything related to the rag movement?
Well, there was a pretty strong Occupy movement here.
Yes.
But
the day that we were kicked out, 440 people were on the ground, and 80 went over 80 went to jail.
Yeah.
Including almost David, the candidate for Attorney General.
Yeah. David Van Os.
Yeah, David Van Os.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to say that what we are seeing now is nothing short of amazing. I mean, I think on many fronts, you're seeing like women activists will call for a meeting and it'll get so big that 400 people will show up, or the Austin Justice Coalition, which is a Black Lives Matter group, they'll get 400 at the Unitarian Church and have to move to a new location, or Democratic Socialists of America have outgrown their site and are now moving to Schultz's on Third Thursdays. And so what you're seeing now is an enormous amount of people looking for ways to connect and be active. And so we have a demonstration on account, as you mentioned, but there's a demonstration at 4:30 called One Resistance. I don't know, Mark, if you want to just...
Auditorium Shores.
Yeah, 5 p.m. And then the next day, a women's march that will be taking place here as the one in Washington takes place. And then you have a huge, really well-organized immigrant rights movement in Austin with grassroots leadership. And so all of these things offer us opportunities to connect right now. And I really think that the work that we have to do is the connective tissue work that this newspaper did for Austin for a long time. It's not so much drilling into your silo issue as it is connecting and understanding the kind of power we can build and the community we can build that can sustain us through dark times.
I think there's probably more activism than there's been at any time since the Iraq War. And it's a different kind of thing. I think it's the kind of, like you're saying, that people are just pulling together and seeing themselves. Some people are sort of seeing this as a coalescing resistance movement. Yeah.
Glenn.
Oh. I read today that the city of Austin has 50 vacancies on commissions and boards that they need to fill in. So that would be a good place for a lot of people to
Good, good, good.
Okay. The SCS had a big national meeting. Was it 1970 in Austin? What was the RAG role in that, either in making that happen here, and then
spring of 69?
69. Spring
was it 69?
What was the RAG role in either?
Do you know that? Do you much know about that answer? Could you?
Wasn't that when Frank Irwin, the chairman of the board, cancel the ability of SDS to meet on campus? And so they were in that big room, that we did the layout of the RAG. People were sleeping on the floor, wall to wall.
And it was at the Catholic Student Center, right? It had to move off campus to the Catholic Student Center. I was not in Austin, I don't think.
I wasn't here either.
Dawn was. So, David, you were here. Were you here then?
You see, some of us went other places and came back. It's a strange thing about us.
Glenn.
I just wanted to respond to respectfully sort of add to, maybe slightly disagree with Alan's point about the last 2 years of the RAG. Richard and I started working volunteering for the RAG in 1974, and I came back to Austin to graduate school. And a lot went on with the RAG from 74 till almost the end in 77. And yes, the Vietnam War ended in April, and that was a big part of the engine of the movement, you're right. But the women's movement and the gay liberation movement and the civil rights movement had built a lot more, and a lot more was going on past the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War. And so I wrote regularly for the RAG, laid out, and so forth. Richard wrote regularly. There was a whole team of people.
Hey, I laid out. I typed.
Learned from the great writers that came before us, Judy Smith, Lynn Smith,
and my
Bill Meacham. We were right. I mean, Hunter Ellingworth, one of my mentors. I mean, we had some great people covering city politics. We wrote about co-ops. Co-ops were beginning to flourish. The anti-war nuke movement was starting. Environmentalism was starting. Vegetarianism. Know your health. Know your body. Sexuality. Discussion of Buddhism. Meditation. All of this flowering of the counterculture was documented ongoing. 74, 75, 76, 77. The other topic that I and some others covered was the growing labor movement. There was farm workers were organizing. Farm workers were going on strike. There was a
economy firm
in 75.
That's too early.
The shuttle bus drivers went on strike right here at UT, and it was a radical hippie union that then won a contract and then began integrating into the blue collar working class. Bus drivers union across town, and bus drivers wrote about their strike in the RAG, 72 and 76. And, you know, the other thing is that we all learned from our predecessors on the RAG that you not only wrote about stuff, you organized. You went out in the streets and you organized, and then you came back and you wrote about it. And there was no pretense about being objective. You know, it was like advocacy journalism, and we're proud of it.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot that we did. There was a lot of institution building and community building, like Richard said, that went on 74 to 77. The women's health movement set up clinics. They promoted and educated for women doctors, rape crisis centers, counseling, support, Middle Earth drug counseling. I mean, it's just on and on. So a lot was going on, and the RAG supported it and wrote about it and promoted it.
The Chile Committee.
One thing about objectivity is that we made it very clear openly that not only were we not objective, but we didn't think there was any such thing. It's a construct, and certainly if people talked about the mainstream media being somehow objective, well, look at who owned the media. You know, who decides what articles go in, even if a reporter tried very hard to do, who makes all those decisions? So it was always very clear. We said that we weren't objective, but we tried to always be honest.
Hi, my name is Tracy Schultz. I am the engineer of RAG Radio. For this week's episode of RAG Radio, we are rebroadcasting the audio from an event on January 5th, 2017, here in Austin, Texas, at Book People. At the event, your RAG Radio host, Thorn Dreyer, along with Alice Embry and Richard Croxdale, was celebrating the launch of their book, Celebrating the RAG, Austin's Iconic Underground Newspaper, with discussion, Q&A, and we also got a chance to hear from RAG contributors, Alan Pogue and Carry On. For more information about the book, the RAG Radio Show, and more on the RAG itself, you can go to theragblog.com. Thank you so much for listening.